I just have a brief announcement to make. Unfortunately, Sir Robert Jennings, our honorary fellow and former justice of the International Court, is unable to be with us this evening owing to flu. But very kindly, Sir Arthur Watts has agreed to step in. Sir Arthur Watts is the former legal advisor to the Foreign Office, and he's Robert Jennings' co-author of the great work, The Treatise by Oppenheim on International Law. So, Sir Arthur Watts.
My lords, ladies and gentlemen, it is a great pleasure for me this evening to introduce our speaker, Judge Rosalind Higgins. In many ways, and particularly in these surroundings, Judge Higgins requires no introduction. She was, in her previous incarnation, as most of you will know, Professor Higgins, the holder of the chair in international law at this school. And I suspect that there are many here who still think of her habitually and will continue to do so for quite some time as Professor Higgins. She held that chair, or has held that chair, no, held that chair. I'm falling into the fault. She held that chair since 1980. During that 15 years, she has earned an outstanding reputation for her intellectual and academic contribution to the work of international law. Her writings, as will be well known, are very extensive. But even more than that, she developed a very busy practice at the English bar and also in international litigation. And even more than that, she was very active in the international area generally, particularly as a member since 1985 of the Human Rights Committee, set up under the UN Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. With such a distinguished academic and practical background, it's no surprise that Professor Higgins became, a short while ago, Judge Higgins. And it's wholly appropriate that Judge Higgins should be delivering this evening's lecture in the series of the LSE's centenary lectures in law and society. So I have the great pleasure in inviting Judge Higgins to address us on the Reformation in International Law. Judge.
Sir Arthur, lords, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your kind welcome. My intention in this lecture is to demonstrate the deep commitment of the LSE during its first century to international law and to show that during this 100 years we've witnessed and are witnessing a reformation in the subject. It's a commonplace to trace international law from the earliest organization of society through the Greek city-states, the early Italian cities, the breakup of the Roman Empire into independent states, with mention, of course, of the birth of Grotius in 1583 and the dawn of modern international law. Certainly, the subject was well established by the time that the London School of Economics and Political Science opened its doors in 1895. Indeed, there were no fewer than 18 English language treatises, of which I'm aware, appearing at the turn of the century. Hall's celebrated treatise on international law was, by 1904, already in its fifth edition. And although about half of such tomes was often directed at the laws of war, and the rapid development of the myriad facets of the laws of peace was only beginning, there did already exist a considerable body of law. Lawrence's Principles of International Law of 1898 ran to 645 pages. The turn of the century edition of Hall was some 764 pages. And writing at the very beginning of the 20th century, Westlake and Oppenheim each required two volumes to tell the tale. From the outset, international law has had an important place in the life of the LSE. LSE has produced some of its most outstanding servants. But in the otherwise admirable centenary history of the school, prepared by Ralph Dahrendorf, there's no reference to international law, and the story has still to be told, and I can but outline it this evening. John Westlake, later to become Professor of International Law at the University of Cambridge, was, from 1896 to 97, a lecturer at the LSE. Lasso Oppenheim, who succeeded Westlake at Cambridge, lectured at the LSE from 1899 to 1909. The pattern of export from LSE to the Whewell Chair at Cambridge continued unbroken with Pierce Higgins. He was at the LSE from 1908 to 1923, the last 4 years as Professor of International Law. Arnold McNair and Hirsch Lauterpacht were each in turn lecturer and then reader in international law at the school before taking the seemingly inevitable journey to the Whewell Chair. Sir Robert Jennings, whose first lecturing job was at the LSE from 1938 to 39, was to take the very same path. But we have insistently reclaimed him as one of our own, and he is today an honorary fellow of the LSE, and we greatly regret that a fluish cold prevents him from being with us this evening. Some other eminent names have resisted the lure of the Fens. H.A. Smith was Professor of International Law at the school from 1928 to 1947. And Sir Robert Jennings tells me that his outstanding ability was matched by his kindness, save that he insisted that his junior lecturers give all classes after 4 p.m. so that he could catch the Paddington train. David Johnson, who so encouraged me when I was starting out in this profession, gave important service to the school from 1952 until 1976 as reader and then professor. And Ian Brownlee, who was professor here from 1976 to 1980, left instead for the spires of Oxford and his distinguished tenureship of the Chichely Chair. Though John Westlake is listed as having been an occasional lecturer in international law at the LSE in the 1896 to 1907 session, the archives yield up no hint as to the lecturer or lectures he delivered. It appears that the substantial study of international law at the school began in 1898, when the subject International and Constitutional Law is listed under Political Science as one of the subjects to be studied in that session. However, there do not appear to have been any formal lectures on the subject, and the calendar simply states that Mr. E. A. Whittock will be glad to advise students of these subjects about their work. Those who desire to avail themselves of his assistance are requested to communicate with the director. In the 1899 to 1900 session, Oppenheim gave what is probably the first course of lectures on international law at the school. His course of 5 lectures in the Michaelmas term of that year consisted of the following topics. First, the nature or character and the basis of international law. Second, the sources of the dominion and the codification of international law. Third, the science of international law. And four and five, the historical development of international law. And alongside these lectures by Oppenheim, the calendar again notes international and constitutional law as a subject in respect of which Mr. Whittock remained glad to advise. In the 1900 to 1901 session, international law was removed from the list of political science subjects, and the school's list of lectures and classes included for the first time international and constitutional law as a section on its own. And five subjects were listed under this group. Mr. Whittock's advice on international and constitutional law, as well as the following subjects by Oppenheim: state territory, acquisition and loss of territory, international law of the open seas. In the 1901 to 1902 session, no lectures by Oppenheim are listed. Perhaps this was an early sabbatical. And it appears that the students had to be satisfied with Mr. Whittock's advice. In the 1902-3 session, there was, for the first time, a section of the lectures of the school dedicated in terms to law. And among the courses included was one of no less than 30 lectures on the law of nations in time of war given by Oppenheim. And over the next 2 years, the teaching on international law was further expanded, and soon a trend was started by Oppenheim, whereby he gave a course of 60 lectures on international law over a 2-year period. In 1 year, he'd teach on the laws of war, and in the next, on the laws of peace. And the fee for the yearly course of 30 lectures was £1.05. It's interesting to note that the scheme of these lectures forms the scheme of Volume 1 of Oppenheim's celebrated Treatise of International Law, which was first published in 1905 and dedicated, incidentally, to the silent Dr. Whittock. And the scheme for Oppenheim's lectures at the School on the Laws of War forms the basis of Volume 2 of his great work, published in 1906. Throughout the first decade of this century, international law was included not only in the law section, but also among the subjects for those taking courses in political science. Indeed, Oppenheim, writing the preface for his Volume 1 from LSE Clare Market, February the 20th, 1905, says, and I now quote, "The majority of people in this country who take an interest in international law are not jurists and have no legal training, as my classes at the London School of Economics and Political Science show. For this reason, certain truisms must be repeated again and again." Even after Oppenheim left in 1909, the law of peace and the law of war were still taught in alternate years by Pierce Higgins, a tradition that was to continue until ended by Hugh MacKinnon Wood in 1948. Also, Professor Sir John MacDonald gave courses on diverse topics, including in the 1912-13 session on three very contemporary-sounding themes: the theoretical writers of international law, international treaties, and international law as affecting criminal law. In 1923, after the departure of both Professor MacDonald and Professor Pierce Higgins, Arnold McNair arrived at the school. And in 1924, he started a discussion class on international law cases. In the 1927-28 session, the year after McNair's departure, and the year in which Hirsch Lauterpacht joined the staff, the school created an international studies department, which taught, as one of its courses, Pacific methods of settling international disputes. Lauterpacht was a member of the Department of International Studies, and the early volumes of the Annual Digest of International Law, later the International Law Reports, were published out of that department. And we've recently celebrated, fittingly here at LSE, the 100th volume of this splendid series under the editorship of Professor Elie Lauterpacht and Mr. Christopher Greenwood. The teaching of international law subjects was now divided between the International Studies Department, which in time became the International Relations Department, and the Law Department. And it was at this time that Lauterpacht did his early work on the Permanent Court and pioneered his ideas on the protection of minorities. In 1929, Lauterpacht started a course on the justiciability of international disputes, a course that appears to have developed from his article, The Doctrine of Non-Justiciable Disputes in International Law, in Economica in December 1928. And this article was to form the basis of his seminal book, The Function of Law in the International Community. By 1932, Lauterpacht appeared to have settled firmly in the law department and to have brought with him the courses which he'd previously taught in the International Relations Department. However, the International Relations Department still continued to teach its own subjects on the protection of minorities and on the Pacific methods of settling disputes. That tradition has now died away, and in recent years, the International Relations Department has been content for international law to be taught from the Law Department. But the undergraduate course still continues to attract large numbers of BSE students, and some of them are sufficiently keen and able then to take an LLM course as well. The archives also reveal the beginnings of intercollegiate teaching with celebrated names from the other London colleges appearing in the LSE calendar in jointly taught courses. And this was a period marked by a widening of the subjects taught within international law. Various specialists began to offer air law, law of the sea, war and neutrality, and international economic law. It was David Johnson who introduced the new course on the law of international institutions on the LLM in the 1950s. And I've taught this course here as a specialist course on the United Nations, other international institutions now being well covered in other specialist courses. Cedric Thornbury, in 1971-2, introduced an undergraduate course on the novel topic of international protection of human rights. I revived this topic, which had lapsed with Cedric Thornbury's departure to the UN, and together with Peter Duffy, have taught an ever-expanding master's course, which each year has attracted between 50 and 90 graduate students. During the last decade, the school has also seen the introduction of courses on international environmental law and international commercial law, the original pioneers of each of which, and I see Professor Burney here tonight, are with us. And I introduced a new course on the international law of natural resources with an emphasis on petroleum law. Well, what of the world outside the LSE? It's been instructive to look at the leading textbooks of 100 years ago. T.J. Lawrence, in his treatise on the principles of international law, published in 1898, saw a harmonious continuity and change. Since 1848, he noted, modern international law has been enriched by many new rules, and some of its original precepts have given place to others, generated from the changed practice of modern times. But the continuity of its life has never been broken, and there seems no prospect of any revolutionary change passing over it. I believe that comment remains largely true 100 years later, but while developments have continued at a pace and in a manner unimaginable in 1898, In recent years, we've also seen, it seems to me, changes that, if not revolutionary, can properly be characterized as a reformation. The common understanding of the term will suffice for my purposes. I refer, of course, not to the reform of doctrines and practices of the Roman Church ending in the establishment of Protestant churches, but the secularized sense of the term as a radical change in political or social affairs. The idea of reformation as radical change often also carries overtones of a change for the better. The Harrop's French Dictionary, which I had to hand in The Hague, engagingly defines reformation as retour à la vertu. I feel we're too close to some of the changes to be entirely confident that they do indeed represent the better way, or la vertu, but they do represent more than Lawrence's continuity of life, whereby original precepts harmoniously wane with the waxing of new rules. And I shall try and illustrate this theme with four examples. I speak first of the very concept of international law. Our authors, writing at the birth of LSE, had no doubt as to what was meant by international law. It was, said Lawrence, the rules which determine the conduct of the general body of civilized states in their dealings with one another. Thomas Alfred Walker's Manual of Public International Law, published in 1895, gave essentially the same view. And F.E. Smith, whose shorter monograph on international law was published in 1900, offered an almost identical definition. The theme then was of international law as a system of rules between states based on their consent. And this perception has remained essentially unchanged until recently, though in the last 50 years, all the leading treatises now speak of international law as rules governing international organizations and states in their relations with each other. International organizations were, of course, not unknown before World War II. The League of Nations and the International Labour Organization had existed since 1919. But with the advent of the United Nations in 1945, there were two important developments. The United Nations presaged both in its family of specialized agencies and in a myriad of international bodies beyond an enormous growth in international organizations. If they were not to be the creature of the states where they had their headquarters, and if indeed they were to have a legal personality distinct from the states who created them, their status and relations inter se would have to be governed by international law. We can confidently say today, then, that international law is the body of law applicable to states and to international organizations in their relations. But what of individuals? My view, which is perhaps less than orthodox, is that the reach of international law to individuals is limited only because it's rare that the individual comes into contact with the subject matter that's regulated by international law. But where he does, I see no reason of principle why the individual should be regarded as beyond the reach of international law, whether in relation to his entitlements, for example, the entitlement of compensation for expropriation of property abroad, or to the entitlement of basic human rights, or his duties. The extraordinary changes in our perceptions about the entitlement of individuals to human rights surely is to be described as a reformation and not mere seamless development. As to the duties of individuals under international law, it has long been accepted that an individual may bear international criminal responsibility. In 1945, the Nuremberg Tribunal said, and I quote, "It was submitted to us that international law is concerned with the action of sovereign states and provides no punishment for individuals. And further, that where the act in question is an act of state, those who carry it out are not personally responsible. But these submissions must be rejected. Individuals have international duties which transcend national obligations of obedience imposed by the individual state. He who violates the laws of war cannot obtain immunity by claiming to act in pursuance of the authority of the state. In 1945, it was envisaged that this principle was to be enforced either by a tribunal of the victorious powers at the end of a conflict or by national courts. Today, we witness a reformation in the area of international criminal responsibility. In 1993, the Security Council established an international criminal tribunal for the former Yugoslavia to bring to justice those responsible for the grave breaches of international humanitarian law occurring in the region. Manifestly, this is a tribunal established by the UN and not by those obviously involved in the physical conflict. The tribunal has acted with extraordinary vigor in drawing up its rules and in proceeding to issue indictments and, where possible, so far in a single case, to move to proceed to trial. The tribunal, faced with the reality that nearly all of the named perpetrators are safely within Serbia and Croatia, and that the former, at least, are unlikely to be delivered up, has nonetheless set an important task for itself. By issuing indictments based on detailed examination of evidence, it has fulfilled the important function of bearing witness to events. Further, the statute imposes an obligation on all UN members to comply with the orders of the tribunal, including those for the arrest of suspects. Accordingly, once an indictment is handed down and an international arrest warrant issued, the persons named are effectively precluded from traveling. The issuing of indictments has generated an important momentum of its own. For example, not only are General Tadic and Radovan Karadzic unable to participate in the current talks on the future being held in Dayton, Ohio, but the United States has proposed that the new constitutional arrangements would preclude from election anyone under indictment by the War Crimes Tribunal. And President Tudjman has this weekend indicated that he will hand over indicted Croats for trial. Notwithstanding all the problems that the tribunal faces, one cannot be impressed by all that it's done in such a short period. And the impact upon our expectations of what is not acceptable is not to be underestimated. And there's another important consequence of the tribunal. It's shown that many of the problems associated with the setting up of a permanent international tribunal for all such crimes, wherever perpetrated, are not insurmountable. The main obstacle may now be that of political will rather than of technical difficulty. There's another radical phenomenon afoot. Not only are individuals increasingly regarded as the bearers of rights and duties under international law, individuals, or rather groups of individuals in the form of non-governmental organizations, are now demanding a say in the formation of international law. This is occurring both directly and indirectly. Treaties are one of the sources of international law. And in our new world, a government can no longer go to a lawmaking conference with only its own agenda. It will have been bombarded by interest groups, who in turn will have made every use of the media to build up interest for their demands as to what the government's position should be. International conferences on environmental law furnish a ready example. And a particularly well-respected non-governmental body, such as the International Committee of the Red Cross, may play a more direct role in the formation of norms. although the formal parties to the humanitarian conventions remain states, the texts and expert work have often owed much to the ICRC. NGOs are increasingly acknowledged as interveners in human rights procedures with or without standing. The European Court of Human Rights now allows, under certain conditions, amicus briefs, an opportunity much used by human rights NGOs such as Interrights and Amnesty International. In certain national courts, too, notably in the United States, human rights NGOs are active in the courts, either in bringing actions themselves or in intervening in litigation brought by others. And they're active, too, in the various ways allowed to them in the non-judicial procedures available in the international human rights system, for example, when states make reports under the two international covenants. The phenomenon seems to me to be gathering pace. The draft convention being prepared on indigenous peoples is by no means the property of the states who will be parties to it. Its prime mover and begetter within the UN, the redoubtable Mrs. Dayas, has consulted the representatives of the indigenous peoples at every stage. They have felt very much part of the law-making process. The power of non-state actors is being fueled by another phenomenon too. High-profile conferences on perceived problems are today much in vogue. The Rio Conference on Environmental Law in 1992 was rapidly followed by the Vienna Conference on Human Rights in 1993, and more recently we've seen the Beijing Conference on Women's Rights. The interest of NGOs, and indeed their entitlement to be present at these gatherings, has been an important matter for them and for governments alike. And few can doubt that their involvement, often even at the preparatory stage when agendas are being drawn up, is influential in the outcomes arrived at. The International Court of Justice presently has before it a request for two advisory opinions relating to the legality of nuclear weapons, one from the World Health Organization and one from the General Assembly. By common agreement, it is the NGOs active in the field who have successfully mobilized states' members of these bodies to seek the opinions of the court, opinions which only certain UN organs and specialized agencies may request, and which the NGOs could not, because of lack of standing, have asked for themselves. The United Kingdom, in making submissions relating to the propriety of the court responding to the requests for advisory opinions, brings this fact to its notice. New Zealand, when making its oral submissions to the court, publicly thanks the individuals and groups who've caused this case to be brought about. Clearly, to some, these radical phenomena represent the democratization of international law. To others, it is a degradation of the technical work of international lawyers in the face of pressure groups and a sidestepping of existing international law requirements and procedures. There's now a demand being heard that individuals should, in fact, have direct access to the international court themselves, and that the statute of the court should be amended to this effect. Whether this happens remains to be seen, and nor is it my purpose this evening to explore whether or not this is desirable and what the advantages and problems might be. But who can deny that there's been a reformation in our notions of who are the users of international law and who international law is for? My second example of reformation concerns the explosive and unstructured growth of international institutions of all kinds. The writers of 1895 remind us of a world of occasional state conferences and refer to them as the relevant expression of international will. This last quarter century has seen another remarkable phenomenon, the explosion of the growth of international institutions. The number of UN specialized agencies, for example, has almost doubled since 1945. The main organs of the UN have used their charter power to the full to establish subsidiary bodies. Further bodies within the UN system have been established, which are neither subsidiary organs nor specialized agencies. And of course, they have also been regional organizations with their own cluster of subsidiary and associated bodies. And there are also collective self-defense institutions and sui generis international institutions to deal with each and every problem. On every topic one can think of, trade, environment, human rights, disarmament, there are now a myriad of international institutions and organs, some universal, some regional, some limited to particular states. All of these have been responses to perceived needs and problems. From time to time, there's been a strong resistance to the setting up of these institutions, but the growth has proved irresistible and continues to this day. States now have to seek to participate in, or monitor the work of, or control the budgets of, such bodies. The institutions themselves now begin to see, because of budgetary problems or political considerations, the advantage not only delegating down to new subsidiary organs within the institution, but of delegating their functions outside of the institution altogether, perhaps to a state or to another international organization. We've seen an extraordinary delegation of functions originally envisaged for the Security Council to NATO, with the result that we now have a bifurcation between binding decisions that certain actions do constitute a threat to peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression, and that certain measures are required to support such findings, and the carrying out of the actual measures themselves. This phenomenon has been in evidence in the relationship between the Security Council and the coalition forces in the Gulf, between the Security Council and NATO in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and between the Security Council and the United States in Somalia and Haiti. This delegation of power has been born of desperation and necessity. It's had mixed results on the ground, and has led to operational problems of extraordinary complexity and to frequent incoherence of decision-making processes. One has the impression that the world of international organization is at once expanding to its limits and imploding upon itself. International courts and tribunals have not escaped this phenomenon. There's been a constant drive to search for and provide institutions and procedures that might be sufficiently attractive to states to encourage them to resolve their disputes peacefully. This presupposes, of course, that the desire to avoid conflict is there and that it will be facilitated if more and yet more ways can be presented for resolving disputes. And this has led to a remarkable range of possibilities at the disposal of states for dealing with their disputes. There are ever more inventive ways of seeking to provide consent to judicial or arbitral resolution of disputes. But what there's not been is any comparable weight of research on why it might be that a state finds one method more acceptable than another, and whether this relates simply to the strength of its position in a particular case or to a more generalized reason. What is the relationship between the political will to resolve a dispute and to resolve it peacefully and the availability of a wide range of options for doing so? Do we really still need to continue to search for further and better dispute methods? And is it satisfactory that our knowledge and understanding is so impressionistic? The fact of the matter is that we now have a multitude of international courts and tribunals, but nothing that could be described as a system of international tribunals. The ad hoc establishment of international tribunals without regard for what already exists, what its place must be, and whether it's really needed, is something we passively accept in international law, but would never tolerate within a domestic legal system. There are clearly many serious questions to be asked. Should the judicial function be centralized? And if so, to what extent and with what structures? Because the International Court of Justice has no jurisdictional competence to hear claims from individuals and penal charges against individuals, it's understandable that in human rights and humanitarian law, other special tribunals will be set up. There are, of course, already well-established human rights courts and tribunals, except exercising a special subject matter jurisdiction under their respective treaties. And the existence of these specialist tribunals in human rights seems to work rather satisfactorily. But in other areas where the particular problems of the scope of the international court's jurisdiction, ratione personae, are not central, the thinking behind the establishment of new tribunals is not so apparent. The legal or managerial reasons that are to lead to the establishment next year, for example, of a tribunal to deal with law of the sea matters in Hamburg under the recent Law of the Sea Convention, are not self-evident. The International Court has vast experience in law of the sea questions and a potential jurisdiction over disputes arising under treaties. International law is a horizontal legal order. That is to say, it is an order obtaining between sovereign and formally equal participants. Unlike domestic law, it's not a vertical legal order with clearly established hierarchies that delineate where superior and inferior authority lies. This combined effect of international law being a horizontal legal order, the unstructured and random establishment of courts, and the burgeoning of international organizations, each with a multitude of subsidiary organs, has inevitably led to overlaps and uncertainty. And this is my third theme. The evidence that international law no longer exists in clear and separate categories is all around us. The law on international trade must now concern itself with the law on environment. The law of jus ad bellum, when one may lawfully use force, is heavily circumscribed by the law of jus in bello, humanitarian law that dictates how one may conduct hostilities. The new law of state responsibility regarding the preclusion of wrongfulness is claimed by some to impact upon the law of treaties in the sense of effectively adding grounds for the lawful termination of treaties. And as the Al-Adsani case in the English courts has so recently reminded us, there are issues too as to whether the law on sovereign immunity is to be read in the context of the fundamentals of human rights. I make no comment on this occasion anyway upon the correct answer to these questions of perceived overlap, but the phenomenon is striking. And the practical problems generated by these interfaces and overlaps manifests itself in a variety of ways. There's the issue of subject matter jurisdiction. Does it matter that a topic purports to be dealt with authoritatively in a variety of fora? Customary international law emerges from state practice that's based on a sense of obligation. The plethora of decisions on a particular topic taken by diverse international institutions, organs, tribunals, and states are part of this fabric. But our system for evaluating these, for treating one determination as legally more weighty than another, is distinctly primitive. Sometimes the attempt seems not to be made at all. an argument advanced, for example, by Professor Mendelssohn in his analysis of the International Court's judgment in the Nicaragua United States case of 1985. For some sophisticated analysts of the lawmaking process, the advantages of plurality outweigh the disadvantages. Oscar Schachter, for example, considers any longing for a tidier world to be misplaced. He robustly states, I quote, "Indeterminacies and inconsistencies have played a useful role in attaining important objectives." But there is also a downside that debases the currency. In the field of human rights, for example, we have treaties of general subject matter, now supplemented by single topic treaties, that is to say, treaties on one particular subject that is already one of the elements of the older general treaties. So the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights now exists side by side with the Conventions on the Prohibition of Torture or the Rights of the Child. So long as the interpretations given by the diverse treaty monitoring organs are mutually supportive, this can do nothing but good in emphasizing and further developing specific norms for the application of human rights. But one cannot guarantee, of course, that the diverse decisions on the same subject matter will be mutually supportive, especially in the absence of clear hierarchical superiority of one body to another. And we are beginning to see that evidenced. Where you have two judicial bodies dealing with the same subject matter, there seems to be rather important practical difficulties of overlap. The new law of the sea tribunal that is to be set up in Hamburg is to deal with certain categories of legal disputes arising under the Law of the Sea Convention. But some of that law is, of course, already existing customary international law, and as such is fully within the general subject matter jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. And it's entirely conceivable that these two bodies may have occasion to pronounce on essentially the same issue of law, and notwithstanding the preeminent position of the International Court in the field of international law, there can be no guarantee that they'll say the same thing. Judge Oda has just published a detailed critique in the latest issue of the International and Comparative Law Quarterly. Further, it's in my view misconceived to suppose that the new Law of the Sea Tribunal will be able to draw a neat line around the Law of the Sea issues over which it's been given competence in the Law of the Sea Convention. Cases do not arise in abstracto. Law of the Sea controversies, like any other legal controversy, exist within the framework of other relevant legal norms. In pronouncing upon an issue that falls within its specialized subject matter jurisdiction, the tribunal may well find itself having to deal also with international claims on the substantive law of treaties, for example, or on the identification of customary law. Not only are these formally beyond the subject matter jurisdiction of the Law of the Sea Tribunal, but they have over the years been the subject of weighty jurisprudence by the International Court. Now, it shouldn't be thought that as the newest member of the International Court, I'm for that reason engaged in a defensive support of a sort of restrictive trade practice. Restrictive practices are against all my instincts, and those who know my writings on human rights law knows that the fragmentation of authoritative decision-making has been a long-time concern of mine. Nor, I should add, do I believe that the problems associated with the trend for establishing single-topic courts can be addressed by setting up single-topic chambers within the International Court. There does now exist a special chamber of the court dedicated to environmental law disputes. Court can, of course, already deal with environmental law matters as part of its general jurisdiction. And here, too, controversies will not present themselves simply as matters of one category of law or another. For example, Hungary would regard the current pending litigation with Slovakia on the Gabčíkovo-Nagy Maros dam project as an environmental law dispute. Slovakia would not, believing it to be a dispute about the application of treaties. To take another example, New Zealand's perception of the subject matter of the case it recently sought to bring before the court concerning French nuclear testing was that it was centered on environmental law. France had a very different perspective. My view is that one cannot assign a case to a single topic chamber or tribunal without prejudging where the weight of persuasive argument lies as to the corpus of law predominantly applicable. My predisposition, therefore, is for rather centralized but broadly based judicial decision making. I've already explained why I believe human rights to be an exception to that general proposition. Sir Robert Jennings has, in a recent article in the American Journal of International Law, made a different point, asking if, in the face of these decentralized and ad hoc judicial structures, there should not be an ultimate appeals function for the International Court. What is clear is that the International Court will hold little attraction as either a future final appeal court for diverse tribunals, or a court that today remains an attractive alternative to the setting up of such tribunals, unless it's perceived as being able to determine issues rapidly and effectively. And how that best can be achieved is another question for another occasion, but the task is urgent. The structural changes of which I've been speaking lead not only to uneasy overlaps in the allocation of subject matter jurisdiction, it's led to debate about who may establish what. How much the world has changed from those days 100 years ago when the establishment of a new international body was unthinkable, save by treaty or the concert of states. May an international judicial body be set up by a political organ of an international institution? In 1949, the General Assembly established the UN Administrative Tribunal so that grievances by UN personnel could be judicially adjudicated. The International Court was in turn asked in a request for an advisory opinion whether the Assembly could establish a judicial tribunal as a subsidiary body when it itself had no judicial powers. The International Court held that a UN organ could establish a body with powers it did not have itself, provided they are within the general purposes it had been directed to fulfill. Just a few weeks ago, the International Criminal Tribunal on the former Yugoslavia faced a challenge to its competence by a defendant. Dusko Tadic claimed inter alia that the tribunal was incompetent to proceed to find against him as its very establishment by the Security Council was ultra vires. He contended that the Security Council was charged under the UN Charter with the protection of peace and security and not with the establishment of international judicial tribunals. Some members of the tribunal felt that their judicial function didn't include assessing how they came to exist and that no response should be made to the charge. But the majority in the appeal tribunal decided that the question had to be addressed, and they affirmed, perhaps unsurprisingly, that they were lawfully established and that it was for the Security Council to decide what measures were needed for the promotion of peace and security, and that such measures could include not only the ordering of sanctions, but also the establishment of a tribunal to establish violations of international law. There are a variety of questions that the Tadic case raises, and this is not the occasion to discuss them, but I merely note another radical departure from the old established way of doing things. And I turn to my fourth and final example. We are, I think, witnessing a reformation in the relationship between international law and English law. In 1737, in Barbuit's case, it was first acknowledged that international law is part of the law of the land. But honesty requires us to admit that for many years, the relationship has been a difficult one. As long ago as 1900, F.E. Smith wrote of the English judiciary, "The general verbal tributes to international law, which are so familiar, are not reinforced by practice on this point." Now, how could practice not support the stated principle? The explanations are various. Partly, I think, it lay in the fact that for too long, international law and English law have been treated as if they are different legal cultures. International law is rarely compulsory at university and is not a compulsory bar course. Judges in the past have, I think, often felt uncomfortable when dealing with international law issues. I recall being asked by one judge to confirm his understanding that he did not, as he put it, administer international law in this court. I think all international law practitioners who were before English courts in the 60s and 70s and even the early 80s will recognize my description of laboring to identify and explain the international law issue, seeking to persuade the judge that it was indeed a matter for his court to decide, and then having to resist as best one could the almost invariably successful attempt by the bench to avoid at all costs deciding the point. There were, of course, always exceptions, great British judges who were versed in and cared deeply about international law, and Lord Wilberforce's contribution to international law, for example, was made both in the courts and untiringly outside. But I think the general situation was as I describe it. But matters have changed today beyond all recognition. The impact of European law has played its part, and so too has the pervasive nature of international human rights law. And the Tin litigation provided an extended, some I know would say overextended, exposure to certain issues of international law. The steps of the Reformation have been almost imperceptible, but there have been important markers along the way. One such was the remarkable F.A. Mann lecture by the present master of the rolls, "There is a World Beyond." The Philippine Admiral and Trendex were the cases that so brilliantly helped the English law of sovereign immunity escape from the dead end into which it had gone. Once we'd entered the era of restricted immunity, it was in the English courts that some of the most important remaining issues of sovereign immunity have been determined. Premier Congreso del Partido, ALCOM, the recent KAC, IAC Iraq cases are all landmark judgments. Carl Zeiss Stiftung, Gore Corporation, Buttesgas, Tin Council. Can anyone, in the face of this roll call to which so many more famous case names could be added, doubt that the English courts are a marvelous place for the international lawyer? Today, the international lawyer in the English courts has a sense of a bench thoroughly interested in the issues, more than willing to hear argument on them, entirely ready to dispose of them as any other part of the law of the land. And as with Lord Wilberforce, the commitment goes beyond the judicial function, as the British Institute of International and Comparative Law, under the chairmanship of Lord Gough, have good reason to know. It is, of course, a two-way matter. International lawyers must understand that the role of national courts in pronouncing upon international law is not the same as that of the International Court of Justice. It doesn't do for an international lawyer to, as a common law colleague who is here tonight once disparagingly described it, to incant a religion. The international law advocate must be able to assist a domestic court within the framework of its own needs and have a proper appreciation of the relevant English law cases, issues of statutory construction, and the constraints imposed by parliamentary supremacy. As Hirsch Lauterpacht realized when moving international law at the LSE from the Department of International Studies into the Law Department, international law must be taught as part and parcel of the study of law. Close cooperation between international law and international relations is both natural in every way and desirable, and I believe and hope that during my tenure of the chair at LSE, that interdisciplinary link was nurtured and strengthened. But at the end of the day, international law must know where its intellectual home is. Let me conclude with these words. I hope I've shown that during LSE's first 100 years, there's been not only developments in international law, but certain more radical changes of great structural significance. The journey of staff from the LSE to the Whewell Chair has now abated. In recent years, its breeding ground has rather been Manchester and Sydney, in the form of Professors Bowett and Crawford. But the relations remain close, with the professors of each, and indeed the Chicherley professor too, readily serving on the committees of the others as needed and collaborating today in a variety of matters. But it must be said too that there's been in this period a transformation of the teaching of international law in this country. International law has been important, of course, for the other parts of London University. Important contributions to scholarship and the teaching of international law have been made and are being made in colleagues in such diverse law schools as, simply to name some, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Manchester, Nottingham, Leicester, Essex, Southampton, Exeter, Warwick, Liverpool, Hull, Durham, and one could go on. We at LSE have relied on their writings and asked for their help in examining, and they too are part of the story of international law at the LSE. And I feel very privileged to have had the opportunity for 15 years to be a small part of that continuing history.
Remains for me only to say a very few words of thanks to Judge Higgins. We've heard a superb and perceptive overview of the current international legal framework and the directions in which the reformation of international law has taken us and is likely to take us in the coming years. An overview as appropriate to the 50th anniversary of the United Nations, which falls this year, as to the 100th anniversary of the LSE. Judge Higgins began by noting the contribution of the LSE to the development of international law. Those illustrious names she read out, Westlake, Oppenheim, McNair, and so on, really names to conjure with for the international lawyer. With a great sense of tidiness, which I'm sure is typical of Judge Higgins, she has managed to end her own tenure of the chair at this school precisely at the end of the century that the school has been in existence. And I have no doubt that in reviewing the whole of that century, and not stopping as she might have felt obliged to do in effect in 1980, we will, all of us here, be absolutely certain that Judge Higgins deserves to be mentioned in exactly the same illustrious list of names as those that she chose to read out at the beginning of her presentation. We are greatly in her debt for her presentation this evening and would all like to thank her most warmly for her contribution. Thank you. And if I could finally add that the reception will now take place in the senior common room, which is on the fifth floor of this building. Thank you all very much.